Chapter 3. Hypocritical, not Hippocratic Oath. Every veil secretly desires to be lifted, except the veil of hypocrisy. Richard Garnett. A Hippocratic Oath holds those who swear to it to a strict code of professional and personal conduct. The oath, historically taken by physicians, stipulates that they will do their professional best to administer care regardless of an individual's race, religion, creed, etc. Juxtapose the altruism of the Hippocratic Oath to the oath practiced by self-appointed race healers. I call it the hypocritical oath, and this foundation is based on hypocrisy instead of humanitarianism. These race healers prescribe and administer grievance-laced placebos to exploit the pre-existing condition of victimhood that's afflicting the Black community. In other words, it's the RGI's method of Pavlovian conditioning, and it's difficult to break. Nonetheless, attempting to illuminate the RGI's fallacies to those who've chosen blindness is an exercise in futility. According to BLM's official website, its members, quote, affirm that all Black lives matter, end quote. BLM's affirmation that all Black lives matter absolutely exemplifies the hypocritical oath. Clearly, its All Black Lives Matter motto doesn't apply to the Black lives turned into antimatter by Black thugs, which explains why BLM's favorite Black people to rally for are the, quote, qualified, end quote. The qualified. The qualified ones are Blacks killed by whites. They're the minority within a minority whose deaths will be praised and remembered more than their lives. Members of this elite club have hit the BLM lottery, and the BLM benefits package includes marches with customized slogans / props, canonization with eternal recognition as a martyr despite existing rap sheet, Wikipedia page. But wait, the perks don't stop there. Incessant comparisons to icons of the civil rights movement, i.e. Dr. King, Emmett Till, foundation created with celebrity endorsements, funeral live stream with eulogy delivered by an RGI member. The family gets a settlement, and if not, can make money selling paraphernalia. Be warned, a family quarrel may ensue. Presidential commentary. The white perpetrator will be caricaturized as a racist demon who believes that Black lives don't matter. One super qualified person may even get a shout during the Super Bowl. The disqualified. The disqualified ones are Blacks killed by Blacks. Being murdered sucks, and for these following individuals, it sucked more because the perpetrator was Black. Thus, they were disqualified from national temper tantrums on their behalf, Black Lives Matter hashtags, or any other BLM race-based grievance benefits. Ultimately, disqualified Blacks have to settle for anonymity and simple makeshift rituals, stuffed animal memorials and candlelight vigils, reserved for Black-on-Black homicide victims. For example, on a Labor Day weekend in Brooklyn, New York, 1-year-old Antique Hennis was shot dead while being pushed in the stroller by his father. The bullet pierced his skull, and according to an eyewitness, quote, there was blood all over the stroller, end quote. The bullets were intended for the child's father, who had an extensive rap sheet across 2 states, including weapons possession, controlled substances, automobile theft, and assault. I shot that motherfucker, boasted the urban terrorist after he thought he hit the child's father before a witness shouted back, no, you idiot, you shot the kid. The sins of the father visited his offspring, and no stroller march or any march occurred on the young victim's behalf. In Inkster, Michigan, on a lovely summer day, 2-year-old Kamaya French was sitting on a porch with her dad when an urban terrorist walked up and shot her point-blank range. His motive was retaliation, telling police that he wanted her father to watch her die. The father and the 12-year-old family friend were also shot during this hate crime. Yes, hate crime. In Detroit, 3-year-old Amerika Williams was shot and killed when an altercation over Facebook post occurred outside her home. Someone took out a machine gun and began to fire repeatedly, striking Amerika and 3 family members. In Kansas City, 6-year-old Angel Hooper was buying bubblegum with her father when she was shot in the head during a drive-by. I couldn't help but to notice there were no bubblegum marches. I guess she had to be buying Skittles. Chicago. Year after year, Chicago, also known as the Second City, places first among U.S. cities with the most number of shootings and black homicide victims. Chicago, also called Chirac, due to the warlike conditions in its urban areas being comparable to war-torn Iraq, is brimming with disqualified blacks. To thugs, Chirac is a term of endearment, whereas the RGI thinks the name makes blacks look bad. It's funny how the savages who create those deplorable conditions are never demonized for making blacks look bad. I digress. BLM's website lists 27 chapters, but if black lives truly matter, Chicago should be its headquarters, or at least the biggest and busiest chapter. In short, Chicago, where the son of Mayor Rahm Emanuel was once assaulted and robbed near the mayor's home, is the number one place where black lives splatter via black-on-black genocide. The Chicago Tribune reported that at least 19 people were shot and killed New Year's weekend 2016, including a person gunned down just blocks away from the mayor's home. Another 100 were shot but survived. Within the first 10 days of 2016, more than 100 Chicagoans were shot, 3 times more than 2015. Overall, Chicago's homicides in January 2016 increased 75% compared to January 15. Moreover, from January to the end of March 2016, there were 677 shooting victims, a staggering 88.5% increase from the 359 victims over the same period in 2015. Chicago's first quarter of this year also saw a 72% rise in murders compared to 2015's first quarter. Those 141 Chi-Town homicides over 3 months were more than America's 2 largest cities, Los Angeles and New York, combined. In response to the nearly 3,000 people shot by the end of 2015, Chicago police spokesman Anthony Guglielmelli released a statement that presently holds true. Urban terrorists are the root of the virulent violence. Quote, "So far this year, the majority of the gun violence we've seen are a result of chronic gang conflicts driven in part by social media commentary and petty disputes among rival factions," end quote. Laquan McDonald qualifies. Out of all the Chicago carnage, unsurprisingly, only one particular death was sexy enough for BLM. Laquan McDonald, a 17-year-old black male armed with a 3-inch knife, was shot 16 times by Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke from approximately 10 feet away. Video of the shooting, captured on one police cruiser's dashboard camera, was released to the public 13 months after the incident. Officer Van Dyke was charged with first-degree murder a few hours after the video's release, and hundreds of protesters took to the streets. On the second night of the protests, demonstrators tore off lights from a public Christmas tree in Daley Plaza, and multiple marchers were arrested. On Black Friday, a major shopping day for retailers, protesters chanted 16 shots and other slogans while marching on Michigan Avenue, Chicago's central shopping district. This caused some businesses to shut their doors and police to close Michigan Avenue, a 6-lane street. Jabari Dean, a 21-year-old college student, posted an online threat to kill 16 unspecified white males, one for every shot fired at McDonald, plus any white police officers who might intervene at the University of Chicago. Quote, "This is my only warning. At 10 a.m. on Monday morning, I am going to the campus quad of the University of Chicago. I will be armed with a M4 carbine and 2 Desert Eagles, all fully loaded. I will execute approximately 16 white male students and or staff, which is the same number of times McDonald was killed. I then will die killing any number of white policemen in the process. This is not a joke. I am to do my part and rid the world of the white devils. I expect you to do the same." End quote. The university canceled classes scheduled for the next day. Dean was summarily arrested by the FBI. Had Dean successfully followed through on his threats and been subsequently killed by the police, his casket would have received a hero's welcome from BLMers. Chirac's disqualified blacks. The demise of a child is unnatural, but in Chirac, it's a way of life. Not only are children killed as collateral damage between urban terrorists, these innocent souls are oftentimes targeted. Children are dying before they reach double digits in years. Most of us can remember the anticipation and excitement when transitioning from single to double-digit years. I'm not hyperbolizing when stating that I have emails older than many of the kids dying in urban America. These heinous and unfathomable acts should infuriate the masses and are nothing more than examples of adults failing to safeguard the young. Laws exist to protect children from the many forms of abuse, mental, physical, sexual, neglect, but defending our young against lawless predators should be inherent. Amari Brown. The Windy City, which recorded more murders than any other municipality in 2015, experienced a bloody July 4th weekend. 11 people killed, more than 50 wounded. One of the weekend's victims was 7-year-old Amari Brown, who police said was killed during a drive-by that was likely intended for his father, a high-ranking gang member. The boy's father had been previously arrested 45 times with 12 convictions and was out on bail at the time of his son's murder. Amari had just returned from watching the holiday fireworks with his family when urban terrorists opened fire at a group of people. His father refused to help detectives with the investigation. Amari's death by a black thug meant disqualification. Hamburger Smith. Antonio Smith, affectionately called Fat Baby and Hamburger, loved to make other people laugh, his family members recalled. Also, the fourth grade honor roll student was so smart that he could sell water to a whale, according to his obituary distributed at the church where he was baptized and sang in choir. His framed Washington Park Pee Wee football number 84 jersey stood to the left of his small white casket. His demise was sponsored by urban terrorism. One afternoon, four urban terrorists were driving around looking to shoot rival gang members when they spotted two foes. Certain that these two were targets, one of the urban terrorists, already on parole for another gun-related crime, exited the car to approach them on foot. In the process, he came across Antonio Smith, who was playing in the rear yard of a residence. Believing that the 9-year-old was yelling a warning to his intended victims, he shot Antonio Smith 6 times, hitting his right chest, right outside forearm, center back, right lower chest, right shoulder, and left hand, plus 2 additional graze wounds to the left hand. "I just hit a shorty, I just hit a shorty," was his reaction after hopping into a getaway car. Prosecutors said the shooter also urinated on his hands to cleanse them of gunpowder residue, and then changed his shirt and returned home to comply with his electronic monitoring requirements. Antonio's lifeless body was found on a concrete slab just a few feet from railroad tracks that have long served as the dividing line between the two rival gang factions. Tyshawn Lee. The sins of 9-year-old Tyshawn Lee's gangbanging father cost the fourth grader his young life. According to prosecutors, an urban terrorist, facing 5 felony charges in 3 separate cases, including the murder of 19-year-old Breonna Jenkins and the attempted murder of 20-year-old Deshari Bowens, had a vendetta against a rival gang because his brother was killed and mother shot. He vowed to kill grandmas, mothers, and children. So, his gang of urban terrorists went out daily, armed with guns, seeking revenge. Tyshawn, a kid who loved to play basketball, was spotted at a local park. The urban terrorist, who later confessed that he had originally planned to kidnap Tyshawn and cut off his fingers and ears, approached Tyshawn and asked if he wanted to go to the store. Tyshawn responded that he didn't have any money. The thug then stated that that he buy the fourth grader whatever he wanted. Tyshawn took the bait, and his green trust cost him his life. As they walked down an alley, Tyshawn was shot execution style. The basketball he carried was found nearby. Prosecutors say after murdering Tyshawn, the urban terrorist wanted to return to the park and kill all the kids there, but police were already present. Showing no remorse, the depraved urban terrorist wrote a rap song bragging about Tyshawn's murder and even described how the 9-year-old suffered from the gunshots. "Shorty couldn't take it no more, shorty couldn't take it no more," was a verse on the sociopath's song. Memphis. BLM's website states that it, quote, "is working for a world where black lives are no longer systematically and intentionally targeted for demise," end quote. Well, Memphis is yet another black city where black lives are systematically and intentionally targeted for demise. But since the culprits responsible for the demise of blacks aren't exploitable, because they're also black, BLM stays true to its hypocritical oath and turns a blind eye. Placing second on Forbes' America's Most Dangerous Cities 2015 list and sixth on NeighborhoodScout.com's 2016 Top 100 Most Dangerous Cities in the U.S., the Bluff City doesn't bluff when it comes to violent crime. More than 98% of Tennessee's other communities have a lower crime rate, and one's chances of becoming a victim of either violent or property crime in Memphis are 1 in 13. Additionally, Neighborhood Scout says that Memphis has the 4th, 6th, and 22nd most dangerous neighborhoods. Number 4, East Mclemore Avenue / Latham Street. Number 6, East E.H. Crump Boulevard / South 4th Street. Number 22, Thomas Street / Fraser Boulevard. On its top 25 most dangerous neighborhoods in America list. With the crime index ranking of 1 out of 100, 100 being the safest, Memphis is only safer than 1% of American cities. In 2015, 74.5% of Memphis's homicide victims were black males, and 68.3% were under the age of 35. Additionally, WMC Action News 5 reported that 435 children were shot or shot at in Memphis. The unbelievable amount of young Memphians harmed included 15-year-old Katira Stokes, killed by a drive-by shooting while sleeping, and 7-year-old Kirsten Williams, killed less than 24 hours later by a drive-by shooting as she played with friends in a neighbor's driveway. Many locals believe that 7-year-old Kirsten's death was retaliation for Kateria's death. Despite the 435 children being shot or shot at in Memphis, BLM sits on his hands waiting for a martyr moment, which none of these kids qualify. Memphis, like most majority black cities, has a history of using misdirection and scapegoating as a means of addressing its self-inflicted ailments. Young black males are far more likely to be the victims of homicide here than any other race or gender. But instead of changing its bloody reality, Memphis politicians want to change people's perception of Memphis. Hence the banning of a popular nationally televised show that inadvertently explodes Memphis's dark side. Memphis Commercial Appeal reported, quote, "Elected officials aren't generally known for their camera shyness. Yet, some Memphis City Council members weren't comfortable with local police appearing on a documentary series called The First 48. The series, which airs on the A&E cable channel, follows detectives as they try to solve murders within the first 2 days after the crimes have been committed." Councilmember Wanda Halbert said the show was giving viewers elsewhere around the country a bad impression of Memphis. "I heard out-of-town people say Memphis was out of control," Halbert said. "We were exposing the world to the worst aspects of our city," end quote. The show actually highlighted the amount of time, effort, and sacrifices that Memphis's detectives dedicate to solving homicides. The public, especially where the no snitching mantra is law, has a behind-the-scenes access to a thankless but necessary job. Understanding how detectives operate can potentially help to build a bridge between police and community. Seemingly, the city council prefers a RIF instead of a bridge, even instituting a 4.6% pay cut for the Memphis Police Department. The police union responded by sponsoring billboards that warned, quote, "Danger, enter at your own risk. This city does not support public safety," end quote. The former mayor, A.C. Wharton, blamed the billboards for hurting Memphis's image instead of the true source, urban terrorism, and the liberal policies that enable it. In a sensible piece titled Fiddling Away the Future, Dr. Walter E. Williams, a John M. Olin Distinguished Professor of Economics at George Mason University, questioned the motives of Memphis's mayor, A.C. Wharton. Quote, "What about Memphis Mayor A.C. Wharton's proposal to help his black constituents? He has proposed to dig up the bodies of Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest and his wife and remove them from a city park. One wonders whether he thinks marshaling resources to do that is more important than dealing with the city's 145 murders, 320 rapes, 6,900 aggravated assault calls, and 3,000 robberies. All of the Memphis black homicide victims were murdered by other blacks," end quote. Laughably, the mayor's plan to bring Memphis back from the brink of destruction is by demonizing white people. Dead white people at that. Such a maneuver has solidified A.C. Wharton as one of BLM's favorite mayors. After all, they share the same inaction plan. Ferguson, Missouri memory. Every time Ferguson is referenced, I automatically think of that young black kid's senseless murder. Shot and killed while being in the right place at the right time was truly a tragedy. After all, she was shot and killed while doing her homework at home. And according to her mother, 9-year-old Jamila Bowden was usually the first to yell, "Mom, they're shooting," whenever neighborhood gunshots erupted. However, this round of gunfire didn't give Jamila a chance to warn others, or even take cover. Oh, wait. You do know that other homicides, besides the one, occurred in Ferguson, right? The fact that most readers may have initially believed I was referencing Ferguson's only begotten homicide, Michael Brown, shows the success of BLM's hypocritical oath. Both Jamila Bowden and Michael Brown were two Ferguson natives shot dead. One was a child while the other was depicted as a child. Yet, protesters only chanted, "Hands up, don't shoot," for one of them. The "Hands up, don't shoot" story has been debunked by the Department of Justice, headed by Eric Holder, who arrived in Missouri after Michael Brown's death and declared, quote, "I am the Attorney General of the United States, but I am also a black man," end quote. Furthermore, Holder dispatched dozens of the department's most experienced investigators to Ferguson, searching specifically for possible violations of federal criminal civil rights statutes. For the record, no one violates civil rights more than black thugs do, but I digress. Interviews with witnesses and other residents were conducted, and Holder assured, quote, "I'm confident that through the ability of these people, that we'll be able to make a determination of whether or not any federal statutes have, in fact, been violated," end quote. Ultimately, the DOJ's report found that Brown's rights were not violated, and it even addressed the incessant "hands up, don't shoot" narrative. Quote, "Although there are several individuals who have stated that Brown held his hands up in an unambiguous sign of surrender prior to Wilson shooting him dead, their accounts do not support a prosecution of Wilson. As detailed throughout this report, some of those accounts are inaccurate because they are inconsistent with the physical and forensic evidence. Some of those accounts are materially inconsistent with that witness's own prior statements with no explanation, credible for otherwise, as to why those accounts changed over time. Certain other witnesses who originally stated Brown had his hands up in surrender recanted their original accounts, admitting that they did not witness the shooting or parts of it, despite what they initially reported either to federal or local law enforcement or to the media. Prosecutors did not rely on those accounts when making a prosecutive decision. While credible witnesses gave varying accounts of exactly what Brown was doing with his hands as he moved toward Wilson, i.e. balling them, holding them out, or pulling up his pants, and varying accounts of how he was moving, i.e. charging, moving in, slow motion, or running, they all established that Brown was moving toward Wilson when Wilson shot him. Although some witnesses state that Brown held his hands up at shoulder level with his palms facing outward for a brief moment, these same witnesses describe Brown then dropping his hands and charging at Wilson. End quote. The hands up, don't shoot tail has been dismantled to a point where even the left-leaning Washington Post added it to his annual list of shame, the biggest Pinocchios of 2015. Quote, this phrase became a rallying cry for protest after the fatal shooting of a black 18-year-old by a white police officer, Darren Wilson. Witness accounts spread after the shooting that Michael Brown had his hands raised in surrender, mouthing the words, don't shoot, as his last words before being shot execution style. Democratic lawmakers raised their hands in solidarity on the House floor. But various investigations concluded this didn't happen, and that Wilson acted out of self-defense and was justified in killing Brown. End quote. Instead of hands up, don't shoot, the more fitting phrase is assault a cop, he'll shoot. But since the hypocritical oath maintains the lie of victimhood, hands up, don't shoot will continue to be propagated and recited as if it's gospel. In fact, the apt line, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend, from the 1962 classic Western film, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, is essentially the mission statement of today's black press. The Ferguson fib is printed as Ferguson fact. Jamila Bowden's death yielded no demands that city officials step down, resignation of the entire department, or tribute from the St. Louis Rams football team. Moreover, no self-described urban militia offered a cash bounty for her killer's location, as was the case for Officer Darren Wilson's whereabouts. However, a protest occurred the night following her death. Unfortunately, it wasn't for her. It was directed at the police for shooting and killing 18-year-old Mansour Baal-Bey, a black male, during a drug raid. According to the police, two suspects attempted to escape when officers arrived with the search warrant. Baal-Bey reportedly turned around and pointed his weapon at the officers. He was shot four times. The other suspect got away. Baal-Bey had a stolen gun, and the police retrieved three more guns and an unspecified amount of crack cocaine at the house. The officers who shot him are white. Demonstrators in nearby St. Louis took to the streets, threw rocks and bottles at the police, who arrived with riot gear and armored vehicles, and set fire to a car, vacant house, along with mattresses set out as makeshift barricades. Noteworthy is the fact that Jamila's house is one block away from where Mike Brown was shot. Cleveland's castaway. Cleveland, often referred to locally as the North Coast, is a majority black city and thus infiltrated by urban terrorism. One's chances of becoming a victim of either violent or property crime in Cleveland are 1 in 15. Within Ohio, more than 99% of the communities have a lower crime rate than Cleveland. Furthermore, Cleveland's crime index of 2, 100 being the highest, means that it's safer than only 2% of U.S. cities. Because of its rampant criminality, Cleveland has secured the 23rd spot on NeighborhoodScout.com's top 100 most dangerous cities in the USA. The shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice occurred in Cleveland after two police officers responded to a dispatch call, quote, of a male black sitting on a swing and pointing a gun at people, end quote, in a city park. A caller stated that a male was pointing a pistol at random people in the Kudell Recreation Center. The responding officers reported that Rice reached towards a gun in his waistband upon their arrival, which caused them to shoot at Rice. He died the following day. The gun was fake, but the ensuing protests were real. Tamir Rice's death qualified for the BLM benefits package. Additionally, the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, is seeking to have the gazebo, where he was killed, preserved. 5-year-old Ramon Burnett was also shot and killed in Cleveland, but for obvious reasons, his death wasn't as scintillating to the RGI or BLM. As reported by Cleveland.com, quote, Ramon Burnett's Labor Day weekend started out as typical as any end of summer celebration for a 5-year-old boy. The kindergartner at George Washington Carver Elementary School, known to friends and family as Dink, came to his grandmother's apartment on Louise Harris Drive after school Friday afternoon. He used his heartwarming smile to score a quarter from a family friend. He traded it with a neighbor for a homemade slushie. He tossed the football with the neighborhood children in the yard behind his grandmother's home. Parents watched from their stoops and through the open doors. Then came the gunshots. At 5 p.m., with the sun still shining, Ramon became the youngest victim in a season punctuated by violence in what is becoming one of the bloodiest summers in Cleveland in nearly a decade. When officers arrived, they found the boy lying next to the football that he tossed around with friends. There, the boy who loved Spider-Man and whose mother called him handsome would draw some of his last breaths. End quote. One was shot while holding a football. The other was shot while holding a toy gun. Two tragedies, but only one qualified for martyrdom. Only Oscar is Oscar-worthy. In Oakland, which is number 3 on Forbes' 2015 list of America's most dangerous cities, and number 9 on Neighborhood Scout's list of 100 most dangerous cities in the U.S., exists a 1 in 13 chance of becoming a victim of either violent or property crime. Additionally, more than 99% of California's other communities have a lower crime rate than Oakland, whose West Oakland section has the 15th most dangerous neighborhood in America. Oakland's crime index of 1, 100 being the safest, means that it's safer than only 1% of U.S. cities, and that harrowing statistic isn't because of the police. In 2009, 22-year-old Oscar Grant was fatally shot while handcuffed by a white BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit, police officer. BART settled with Grant's daughter and mother for a total of $2.8 million in 2011. The incident was the basis of the critically acclaimed 2013 film Fruitvale Station, which grossed more than $17 million worldwide from an initial budget of $900,000. But there's another Fruitvale story, and I'm not talking about the sequel to Fruitvale Station. The star of this Fruitvale story is a little girl who would have been a third grader at Fruitvale Elementary School, but instead had her fate determined by an urban terrorist. 8-year-old Alaysha Carradine, whose family affectionately referred to as Ladybug, was shot and killed at her best friend's sleepover. An urban terrorist rang the apartment's doorbell and started shooting as Alaysha's friend opened the door. The bullets pierced the apartment's metal gate and struck 4 of the 5 people inside. Alaysha was killed. Her 7-year-old best friend sustained wounds that weren't life-threatening, as did her friend's 4-year-old brother and 64-year-old grandmother. Alaysha was the youngest of Oakland's murder victims in 2013. Oscar Grant's death qualified him for a movie, while Alaysha Carradine's death didn't even qualify her for a special on BET. Consequently, her story remains untold to the masses. The Black Press. If you watch the Black Press to learn about the state of affairs in the Black community, you'll be informed. If you believe the Black Press about the state of affairs in the Black community, you'll be misinformed. That's because the Black Press, anchored by the National Association of Black Journalists, NABJ, is the official mouthpiece of the RGI, and thus only speaks on the behalf of the qualified. The National Association of Black Journalists Constitution, quote, "We, the members of the National Association of Black Journalists, who are striving for credible journalism that comprehensively portrays the voices and experiences of African Americans and people from the Black diaspora for a society and world that values them," end quote. In short, The NABJ places emphasis on everything black except black violence and criminality. Therefore, it practices the hypocritical oath. It is standard operating procedure to racialize black issues and the so-called black websites. Black Voices, owned by Huffington Post, The Griot, owned by MSNBC, TheRoot.com, owned by The Washington Post, are the heaviest promoters of the victimization narrative. Since employment is fickle in the media field, stories about victimhood receive top billing because they generate high web traffic, which translates into job security. Ebony, a financially struggling black magazine, once started a Save Our Boys campaign, as if blacks are being slaughtered by whites. As far as black-on-black violence coverage, the black press is lackadaisical, yet holds the mainstream media to a standard that it doesn't hold itself. Essence featured a Black Lives Matter edition, but of course, it only featured qualified blacks. Hashtag Black Twitter. Black Twitter is the social media arm of the RGI, and essentially an extension of the black press. In fact, the NABJ and Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism hosted a Black Twitter conference to consolidate the agendas of the black press and Black Twitter. According to Salon.com, Black Twitter is the new Underground Railroad, a, quote, collective of active, primarily African-American Twitter users who have created a virtual community and are proving adept at bringing about a wide range of socio-political changes, end quote. Blacks are Twitter's biggest demographic, 28%, compared to 20% of white, non-Hispanic Americans. And thus, Black Twitter's impact is significant. It uses hashtags to make black topics go viral, create martyrs of the moment, and construct racial grievances. Black Twitter was credited with having stopped a proposed book deal between a Seattle literary agent and one of the jurors in the trial of George Zimmerman. It was also instrumental in a boycott against Paula Deen, a celebrity chef accused of racism, and affiliated companies and sponsors. In short, although some leftist websites consider Black Twitter the Underground Railroad of activism, it's actually a collective of aggrieved armchair activists, hashtagtivists, and keyboard kamikazes. There isn't a black grievance that Black Twitter doesn't attempt to make viral. Do the right RGI thing. When Spike Lee used his Black Twitter privilege to retweet an assumed address of George Zimmerman, the intent was clear. Jorge, the white Hispanic, had to suffer for shooting and killing Trayvon Martin. Spike wanted vigilante justice. However, the address he tweeted to his 250,000 followers actually belonged to a blameless elderly couple in Sanford, Florida. As a result, their home was bombarded with threats and vitriol aimed at Zimmerman. Lee later apologized and claimed that it was a mistake. The apology wasn't enough. The seniors eventually filed a lawsuit against Spike Lee for placing them into imminent danger. In Lee's reality, the mistake wasn't the tweet itself, but tweeting the wrong address. He never shows this level of passion when it comes to vigilante justice for kids killed by urban terrorists. And that's because the criminal element has handcuffed itself to the black community with the black community's consent. Blacks have the key to uncuff the criminal subculture, but refuse to use it. Baitmaster. The black press purports to represent black interests and dialogue, but hesitate to tackle the most pressing issue facing blacks, interracial genocide. Since 1980, blacks have accounted for almost half of the nation's homicide victims, 47.4%, and more than half of the offenders, 52.4%, while only being 13% of America's population. The offending rate for blacks is 7 times higher than for whites, and the victimization rate 6 times higher. Homicide is the number one cause of death for black males between the ages of 15 through 34. From 1993 to 2010, black males ages 18 to 24 had the highest rates of firearm homicides. Blacks are 8 times more likely to be murdered than whites, and black males are 10 times more likely to be murdered than white males. Even though the offender will be a black person 90%+ of the time, black propaganda states otherwise. The Tuskegee Institute conducted a study of all known lynchings of blacks that occurred between 1882 through 1968. During this 86-year span, which is essentially the post-Civil War era up to the Civil Rights era, 3,446 blacks were reportedly lynched. Presently, black-on-black murder eclipses the number of blacks lynched over the course of 8 decades, roughly every 6 months. Baltimore's 2015 ended as its bloodiest and deadliest year on a per capita basis. In 2014, Detroit's police chief called upon law-abiding citizens to take arms against its burgeoning violent criminal subculture. And since the black press is quick to point out that violence is typically intraracial, why would it then shift the blame for the continuous urban carnage on racism? Agenda, agenda, agenda. Along with the black press, apologists in general justify the endemic violence in majority black cities by citing the fact that crimes are largely intraracial. However, the severity of black criminality is unintentionally highlighted when a majority white city like Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, often named as a most livable city, has the 12th most dangerous neighborhood in America. This unsafe neighborhood that made the shameful list isn't a white trailer park neighborhood. It's a black neighborhood. In fact, America's most dangerous cities are never ones dominated by trailer parks, only projects, and subsidized housing. In 2014, 85% of Pittsburgh homicides were black, specifically young black men, including collateral damage victims. In this majority white city, shouldn't white people be the bulk of the homicides? After all, white people commit crimes too. White and white homicides occur too, as I'm often reminded. Blacks are approximately 25% of Pittsburgh's population, and Pittsburgh's police chief, Cameron McLay, told PublicSource.org, quote, "There's a victimology here that is completely unacceptable," end quote. The police chief also acknowledged that police and the community had become acclimated to violence. PoliceSource.org reported further, quote, "In Pittsburgh, only certain neighborhoods bleed." PublicSource.org mapped every homicide in the city from 2010 through 2015. The results show a startling geographic division and clear racial disparity in who suffers the brunt of the violence. There were no killings in Shadyside, none in Point Breeze, where some of the city's wealthiest residents make their homes. In fact, there were no murders at all in the huge area, mostly white and affluent, south of Penn Avenue down to Interstate 376. The murder-free zones run from the eastern city limit up to the borders of Bloomfield and Oakland. But from Penn Avenue and above, in East Hills, Homewood, Larimer, Lincoln, Leamington, Belmar, and the northern part of East Liberty, there were 94 homicides during that 6-year period. More than half remain unsolved. Again, that's nearly 100 murders on one side of the street and zero on the other. The Hill District had 42 homicides. More than half remain unsolved. End quote. Police attribute the violence to a very few individuals, and it doesn't take Columbo to determine the race of the perpetrators. Moreover, if the perps were white with black victims, the unsolved murder cases would likely be zero. Unquestionably, the community would be actively involved. Wilkinsburg, PA, a poverty-stricken, mostly blighted 66% black suburb near Pittsburgh, known for drug trafficking and violence, experienced an incident that's familiar to its bigger sibling. Two urban terrorists methodically shot and killed 6 people, including a nearly 8-month pregnant woman and her fetus, at a backyard cookout. Investigators said one gunman fired from an alley near the backyard party, which prompted the partygoers to run toward a house for cover, where they were ambushed by another rifle-wielding gunman. The police have desperately urged witnesses or anyone with information to come forward. Meanwhile, the black press showed no interest in this tragedy until a white Pittsburgh anchorwoman said something provocative that the RGI could exploit as racism. The anchor woman posted this truthful commentary in part on her Facebook account. Quote, "You needn't be a criminal profiler to draw a mental sketch of the killers who broke so many hearts 2 weeks ago Wednesday. I will tell you, they live within 5 miles of Franklin Avenue and Ardmore Boulevard and have been hiding out since in a home likely much closer to that backyard patio than anyone thinks. They are young black men, likely teens or in their 20s. They have multiple siblings from multiple fathers and their mothers work multiple jobs. These boys have been in the system before. They've grown up there. They know the police. They've been arrested. They've made the circuit and nothing has scared them enough. Now they are lost. Once you kill a neighbor's 3 children, 2 nieces, and her unborn grandson, there's no coming back. There's nothing nice to say about that." End quote. All of a sudden, RGI splinter groups that I had never known existed showed up to feign outrage. Groups such as the Pittsburgh Black Media Federation, who issued a statement that read, in part, quote, "The irresponsible statements demonstrate a persistent problem with how African Americans are negatively stereotyped by too many journalists and news organizations," end quote. Unsurprisingly, there was more outrage about the Emmy-winning reporter's words than the actions of the urban terrorists. Noticeably, no one disputed her assessment, only her, quote, "white privilege," for giving license to her observation. I bet that none of the concerned grievance groups contributed to the burial fund of the victims. Meanwhile, the anchor, under pressure from the PC police, retracted her comments, apologized, and then fell into a sword, all for the delight of the RGI. Ultimately, none of her exhibit remorse mattered. She was fired. Her 18 years on air and accumulation of 21 regional Emmy Awards meant nothing in this age of political correctness. Refer to the Land of the Free, Home of the Offended chapter. Black-on-black genocide is so common that in a rare moment of honesty, the New Pittsburgh Courier openly celebrated when June of 2013 yielded no black homicides. It rejoiced, quote, "The past few weeks have been loaded with news, with the most popular being the Supreme Court decisions on affirmative action, voting rights, and gay marriages. But there was an even bigger news story that occurred that most of the media missed. It was huge. No black homicides in the month of June. Yes, you read it right. No black homicides in the entire month of June. Zero," end quote. Although Pittsburgh, called the Steel City because of its many steel-related businesses, lost the steel industries, unemployment didn't cause it to sink into a dystopia as Detroit did. Pittsburgh, also known as the City of Bridges, is yet another place that the RGI would use as a bridge into victimhood while burning the bridge to accountability. BLM's favorite doctor. If BLM had a primary care physician, it would be Dr. Kermit Gosnell. Like BLM, he practiced the hypocritical oath. Although women's health was professedly the primary focus of his Women's Medical Health Society clinic in Philadelphia, the clinic actually focused on the health of prophets. Over 3 decades, Dr. Gosnell made millions of dollars performing thousands of dangerous abortions, many of them illegal late-term procedures. Dubbed as the House of Horrors, his clinic had no trained nurses or medical staff other than Gosnell, a family physician not certified in obstetrics or gynecology. Dr. Gosnell's practice accommodated women who were too pregnant and couldn't get abortions elsewhere. Under Pennsylvania law, abortions are illegal after 24 weeks of pregnancy, and most doctors won't perform procedures after 20 weeks because of the high health risks. Dr. Gosnell, on the other hand, interpreted this high risk as high reward. The bigger the baby, the more he charged. He didn't advertise, but word got around. He had cornered this niche market. Women came from across the city, state, and region for illegal late-term abortions, paying $325 for first trimester abortions and $1,600 to $3,000 for abortions up to 30 weeks. The clinic took in $10,000 to $15,000 a day, authorities said. The grand jury report stated that he regularly delivered live, viable babies in the third trimester of pregnancy and then murdered these newborns by severing their spinal cords with scissors. Sometimes, Gosnell even joked about the babies, saying one was so large he could, quote, walk me to the bus stop, end quote. Philadelphia's district attorney detailed the clinic's environment, quote, when the team members entered the clinic, they were appalled, describing it to the grand jury as filthy, deplorable, disgusting, very unsanitary, very outdated, horrendous, and by far the worst that these experienced investigators had ever encountered. There was blood on the floor. A stench of urine filled the air. A flea-infested cat was wandering through the facility, and there were cat feces on the stairs. Semi-conscious women scheduled for abortions were moaning in the waiting room or the recovery room, where they sat on dirty recliners covered with blood-stained blankets. All the women had been sedated by unlicensed staff long before Gosnell arrived at the clinic, and staff members could not accurately state what medications or dosages they had administered to the waiting patients. Many of the medications in the inventory were past their expiration dates. Surgical procedure rooms were filthy and unsanitary, resembling a bad gas station restroom. Instruments were not sterile. Equipment was rusty and outdated. Oxygen equipment was covered with dust and had not been inspected. The same corroded suction tubing used for abortions was the only tubing available for oral airways if assistance for breathing was needed. Fetal remains were haphazardly stored throughout the clinic, in bags, milk jugs, orange juice cartons, and even in cat food containers. Gosnell admitted to Detective Wood that at least 10 to 20% were probably older than 24 weeks, the legal limit. In some instances, surgical incisions had to be made at the base of the fetal skulls. The investigators found a row of jars containing just the severed feet of fetuses. In the basement, they discovered medical waste piled high. The intact 19-week fetus delivered by Mrs. Mongar 3 weeks earlier was in a freezer. In all, the remains of 45 fetuses were recovered. At least two of them, and probably three, have been viable. End quote. In addition to performing illegal abortions, Dr. Gosnell ran an illegal pill mill. The doctor of death is currently serving life plus 30 years. Despite the serial killing of babies and massive amount of blood Gosnell had on his hands, the RGI conveniently looked the other way. However, another notable black doctor, who happens to be a retired neurosurgeon, staunchly pro-life, and practitioner of the Hippocratic Oath, wasn't extended the blind eye treatment. This doctor is Dr. Ben Carson, and he was called a coon on social media by RGI member Anthea Butler. Interestingly, Gosnell has yet to be called a coon for what he did for more than 30 years, but Dr. Ben Carson was name-called because his racial authenticity wasn't validated by the self-appointed gatekeepers of blackness. Such is the state of affairs in the black community. Anthea Butler, a black Ivy League professor and Black Lives Matter supporter, tweeted, quote, if only there was a Coon of the Year award, end quote, in response to Dr. Ben Carson's belief that people have the right to display Confederate flags on private property. Black professors such as Walter E. Williams and Thomas Sowell are also typically considered coons since they are not RGI stockholders. However, the irony is that Dr. Carson saved people, whereas Dr. Gosnell killed people, babies specifically. One doctor practiced the Hippocratic Oath, while the other practiced the Hypocritical Oath. Even so, Gosnell was never called a coon or anything close to the derogative term. The RGI consistently supports black killers of blacks, regardless of the victim's age or stage of life.